Welcome to History 605, South Dakota State Historical Society's podcast, where we talk to historians, curators, filmmakers, artists, and authors about how they interpret the past.
10,000 years from now, I think we can meditate and wonder whether our descendants, because I think they'll still be here, what they will think about us. And let us hope that at least they will give us the benefit of the doubt.
I'm Dr. Ben Jones, South Dakota State Historian and Director of the State Historical Society. Join me and our guests as we think historically.
So it is most appropriate and fitting that in our first year of our second century that this should also be a year of reconciliation between the Indian people and the non-Indian people alike.
History 605 is sponsored by the Gruver Family Trust and done in partnership with South Dakota Public Broadcasting. Welcome to the show. Welcome to History 605. Today on the show, we have April White. April is a senior writer and editor of Atlas Obscura. She previously worked as an editor of the Smithsonian Magazine, where she oversaw the publication's history-focused coverage. She holds a master's degree in history and has told surprising tales from the archives of publications including the Washington Post, the Atavist Magazine, and JSTOR Daily. An experienced researcher, she's also collaborated with nonfiction authors about various book projects of their own. In addition, April has authored and co-authored 8 cookbooks and is the former food editor of Philadelphia Magazine. But why we're having her on the show today is her recently released book, Divorce Colony. April, welcome to the History 605.
Thank you so much for having me.
I saw the excerpt of your book in the Smithsonian Magazine and started reading it, and I was just kind of floored as I sat in my house in Sioux Falls to hear all this Sioux Falls history. I wonder, had you visited Sioux Falls before you hit upon this topic?
No. I saw the words in an old newspaper recently returned from the divorce colony, and that was what led me to Sioux Falls.
Okay.
But I had not previously had an opportunity to visit before I started my research.
Yeah. So Sioux Falls at one time, would you say from the 1880s until the first decade of the 20th century, was known as the divorce colony? That was a term that was used at the time?
Yeah, absolutely. So newspaper reporters coined this term, and they had used it for various other places, but it really stuck in Sioux Falls. And it starts getting applied to the city in 1891 when you have the first of these really prominent East Coast socialites coming out to get a divorce. Mm-hmm. And the national newspaper attention follows them. And that's how Sioux Falls gets this reputation.
Okay. Well, perhaps before we get into these 4 cases, which you wonderfully organize around these very interesting women and their situations, I thought we'd start a little bit about thinking about maybe the history of marriage. And before we chat about divorces that occurred in your book and in the early 20th century, I thought it would be good to discuss how marriages are put together in the first place and kind of contextualize, you know, for the audience, how marriage was viewed in the 1880s and 1890s. Was it as common as it was for these women who were a part of very powerful families for the young men and young women in the marriage not to be for love not necessarily to be the only guiding factor in them getting married? In other words, if you are from a wealthy family and you were the father or the mother of a prospective young man or woman getting married, did you see yourself very actively guiding them in their choices about who they would marry?
You know, the father of one of the women I talk about in this book actually bemoans the fact that in the United States, throughout this time, it's typically a person picking their own spouse. Now, his daughter's marriage had gone awry, and so he was sort of saying, man, we should be more like those continental Europeans who are really influential over who their child picks as a spouse.
Mm-hmm.
But we do see in these prominent families and in a lot of relationships that societal pressures do play a big role in who they've chosen to marry. So they are, of course, most likely to marry within their own society circles. And all the women I write about in the book marry for different reasons, because as you point out, we're sort of seeing a change in marriage during this period. We're moving from that real economic model of the early days of the United States toward, you know, sort of that idea of the love marriage that we have today. Mm-hmm. And we're really in that transition during this period.
When would you say that that transition was complete? Or when, I guess maybe the best question is, when did it begin and when did that transition be completed?
Well, you start seeing it when women have more, not a lot, but more opportunities to make some choices. Mm-hmm. And you also start seeing it with the industrialization of the United States. So as it becomes slightly easier to raise a family in the United States, so for instance, you don't need to have a family farm where you have to have many people on that farm in order to make it run, mm-hmm. right? As we get more industrialization, you can have these smaller families. You can make choices that are not entirely about the economics of a family. And so we start seeing that change. We don't see it sort of fully evolve, and maybe we still haven't for some people in some places, until we have women having those same economic opportunities that men did, mm-hmm. such that they are free to make a choice for reasons of love instead of reasons of social standing or political value or economics.
Mm-hmm. How common were divorces in, say, the 1880s, 1890s?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, because up until just before the dawn of the divorce colony, so up until 1889, no one really knew. But the government decided to undertake a study of marriage and divorce and to try to understand how many divorces there were in the United States. And they came up with a number that they released in 1889 that, of course, had nothing to compare it to, but it certainly sounded big. Mm-hmm. So they had counted that in the 20 years previous, sort of the period from the Civil War through, you know, the late 1880s, that there were 328,716 divorces. Now, no one had ever counted before, so there was sort of no way to know, but that sounded big. Mm-hmm. And also, they knew that during this time period, divorces were increasing. And that's one of the things that led to the Sioux Falls divorce colony being such a pivotal moment, is because people had put some numbers on divorce and had started to believe that this was a problem.
Mm. And why does Sioux Falls, you briefly describe it in your book and then kind of reiterate it from time to time, why does Sioux Falls become the place, or South Dakota become the place, where divorces are where they come to gravitate to, and it becomes the colony?
So first, South Dakota mm-hmm. Becomes the place that people think about getting quote-unquote easy divorces because of a law that was held over from the time of the Dakota Territory. So during the Dakota Territory, there was a law put in place that allowed anyone who lived in the state for 90 days to file for a divorce. And that period of time was shorter than it was in any other state except for North Dakota, which also had this law held over from the days of the Dakota Territory.
Okay.
So that meant that if the laws were unfavorable toward your divorce in your state, you could move to South Dakota, stay there for 90 days, and file for release. Now, I should say, this was not designed to make divorce easy. This was simply because South Dakota wanted people who came to their state to be able to participate in all kinds of civic life very quickly, because it was a young state and growing.
Right.
So this was just sort of coincidence that the divorce also fell under these laws. Now, Sioux Falls became the attractive place to go because it was the most accessible place from the east. It had 5 railroad lines that came into the town, and it also had the best hotel for hundreds of miles, and that was attractive to East Coast socialites.
Yeah, so you go through a wonderful description of that attractive hotel. I was wondering if you could tell us about the Cataract Hotel.
Sure. The Cataract Hotel had a couple of incarnations over the course of its life, mm-hmm. but by 1891, it is this big structure at 9th and Phillips, and it is just the center of life in Sioux Falls. So even before the divorce colonists began to arrive, this is where everything happens. This is where you celebrate statehood. This is where, you know, any traveling salesperson who comes through town sets up shop. This is just the center of all civic life. It is also the nicest hotel. It is attractive to these people who are more used to New York accommodations. And so really quickly, it becomes a headquarters for divorcees as well.
So is it, the Cataract is more appealing than anything in Fargo or Bismarck? Is that the case?
It just had more amenities and was also easier to get to.
Yeah. Interesting. So it's a couple of things that bring it in. The state statutes hold over from territorial days and then the connections with the railroads. That's good.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I wonder if you could take us through the four characters, these Maggie, Mary, Blanche, and Flora that you bring to life for the reader and talk about how you got to know these women.
Yeah, so when I first came to this topic, I will absolutely admit that the thing that excited me about it in those early days was just the drama and the scandal around the divorce colony. It was only later I realized what an important historical story I could tell through the women who came out to the divorce colony. So I should start off by saying that it was not only women who came to Sioux Falls. Men came too. But it was the women who caused the panic. It was the women who got people all concerned about what it was that was going on in Sioux Falls, because these women were trying to use the laws to gain their own freedom. Lots of women came, and there are lots of women who I love to talk about and certainly considered as main characters of the book. But I landed on these four women because they let me do a couple of important things. They let me tell the whole arc of the story. So the women you mentioned run roughly chronologically through the time period of the divorce colony.
Mm-hmm.
They also are very different women who married for different reasons, were divorcing their husbands for different reasons. So I really got to look at all kinds of different things that would bring women to Sioux Falls or bring women to seek a divorce in that time. And then they let me cover a couple of really important aspects of the divorce debate. So the first character you mentioned, Maggie. This is Maggie DeStewers. She's a niece of the influential Astor family,
mm-hmm.
and she has married a Dutch diplomat, a baron, who everyone knows as the Baron. And she comes to Sioux Falls because she believes that her husband is attempting to institutionalize her and take control of her fortune. So she is accusing him of all kinds of evils against her. When she comes to Sioux Falls, she sparks this idea of the divorce colony, and she also angers the local bishop and sort of sets him off on his course to destroy the divorce colony. So through Maggie, I get to talk about divorce and religion,
mm-hmm.
And sort of talk about what that influence was and how it shaped debates at the time. The next character in the book is Mary Nevins Blaine. And Mary is a young aspiring actress who eloped with the son of who was then the Republican standard bearer and later becomes the Secretary of State, James G. Blaine. And she elopes with his son, Jamie Blaine, when they're both teenagers. And so through Mary's story, I get to talk about the intersection of politics and divorce. And so that was an important reason I picked Mary. With Blanche, whom you mentioned, this is Blanche Molyneux.
Mm-hmm.
Blanche had the misfortune of marrying a man who went on trial for murder. Now, he was suspected of two murders, the one he was tried for, and also the death of a former lover of Blanche's. He was convicted of the murder he was tried for, but appealed, and on appeal, his conviction was overturned in a second trial. Now, Blanche lived in New York, and in New York, you could only get a divorce at the time with proof of adultery. So despite the fact that Blanche believed her husband to be a murderer, she had no cause to divorce him. Huh. So she leaves and goes to Sioux Falls to get her freedom.
Uh-huh.
So through Blanche, I have an opportunity to look at the intersection of law and divorce. Also, it's just the most scandalous story that happens in all of the divorce colony. And then finally, Flora Bigelow Dodge, the last character I focus on, is an opportunity for me to look at divorce and society. Now, Flora comes to Sioux Falls about a little over a decade after the original divorce colonists. And things have changed in that time. And so when Flora comes to Sioux Falls, what she's looking for is not just her legal freedom. She is looking for what she considers to be a dignified divorce. So she makes every effort she can to get a divorce that will be accepted by society. So in Flora, we see the ways in which attitudes toward divorce change over this period of time,
mm-hmm.
and how the divorce colony helps lead to this greater sense of acceptance around divorce.
Hmm. Well, I often talk to students and others about how history is change over time. And so you're walking through those four examples that you provided in your book is a great example of seeing how these changes are happening. I wonder if Mary Nevins Blaine, she particularly struck me as a fascinating story because of who her father-in-law was, James G. Blaine. You mentioned is heavily involved in Republican politics, and he directly he's Secretary of State when South Dakota becomes a state. He's part of the national political scene that pulls South Dakota into statehood when the Republicans retake power in 1888 and then in 1889, and then later that year South Dakota becomes a state after nearly a decade of Washington politics preventing that from happening. But one of the things that he puts into our Constitution and into several other states' Constitution is what is today widely regarded as an anti-Catholic measure, which prohibited public funding of parochial schools, which was kind of a non-direct but a very direct and impact way of maintaining or not having the public funding for Catholic schools. And you bring out a little bit that Mary is Catholic. She's not only a Democrat, but she's Catholic. And I just kind of chuckled to myself when I read that. I thought, this is going nowhere. If he has such animus for Catholics at the national level, he's pulling all these strings in these state constitutions while he's Secretary of State. And he does. In fact, he succeeds North Dakota, Montana, I think somewhere, and then subsequently over 20 states have these amendments in their constitution, and he's part of that.
Yeah, Mary had many strikes against her, and her Catholicism for James G. Blaine was certainly probably one of them.
Yeah, yeah. As they traveled and they kind of gained their notoriety, what's the response from the local press and the national media regarding what's going on?
The women who come out to Sioux Falls are certainly not looking for the attention of
right.
the media.
Right.
You know, they are hoping to quietly execute this errand. But the newspapers just love this story. So, you know, one of my great sources for this book was the Argus Leader, which was publishing, mm-hmm. You know, in the 1890s and covered the divorce colony. Oh, gosh, the way TMZ covers celebrities, you know, you knew where they had dined
right.
and when they were getting on a train
wow.
and, you know, who was seen outside their hotel room. And then you also had a lot of national papers who either had correspondents in Sioux Falls or sent reporters to Sioux Falls to sort of camp out in the Cataract hotel lobby
mm-hmm.
and get the scoop and find out what was happening with these women. So you definitely see a fascination with these women, even as the locals and the national press, for the most part, are, you know, declaring this to be a scandal and to be a terrible thing, they cannot get enough of this story.
Right. Well, and do they, it seems from reading your book that they kind of come down on, for the most part, they're not hounding these women. They're not accusing these women. They're kind of explaining, with some exceptions to that, I guess, but the media seem to be on the sides of the women who are traveling to the colony. Is that the case?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. Yes, I would say that they were on the side of the story.
Yeah,
and they could,
well,
that,
true
that
enough.
That's where they got the story.
Yep.
You know, often from the women who were there. So those are usually the voices that you heard.
Okay.
But yeah, I would say that largely they were not interested in making declarations about divorce. They were just more interested in telling a good story.
Okay. And were they checking in on the Baron and Jamie Blaine on what their views were, or did they not chase that story down?
There was less of that, mm-hmm. In part, I think, because you just didn't sort of have this critical mass of
true.
You know, husbands who were, you know,
congregating
on the
in
other
a hotel.
Side in
yeah.
one place. But you certainly had people reporting on what these men were up to, just not with the same focus.
Mm-hmm. And is there any, the Cataract staff or the ownership and so forth, is there any sense of what they thought of this? The owner of the Cataract Hotel, did they like this notoriety or what was their?
Yeah, so from what I can determine around the owners of the Cataract House in the 1890s, this has been the Corson brothers, their attitude seemed to be towards the divorced colonists and anyone else who might stay in their hotel,
mm-hmm.
Is if you can pay, cool. Like, mm-hmm. come on over. They mm-hmm. didn't seem to have a whole lot of moral stance on why people came to Sioux Falls, simply that they did and that they could provide a boost to the local economy.
Right.
And I think that's where you saw most of the initial acceptance of the divorced colonists, those who were not outspoken against them, benefited in some way from their presence. And so, you know, the idea of bringing a lot of wealthy women to a young city was, you know, pretty popular.
Right, right. Well, somebody who from this was not very popular was Bishop Hare. And I was wondering if you could describe to the audience who is the gentleman who's kind of leading the charge against this divorce colony and women coming here and men coming here for divorces and what was his motivations?
Yeah, so this is Bishop William Hobart Hare, and he is an Episcopal bishop who had been in the Dakota Territories for a number of years already and was very well respected in the region. He had, with the help of the Astor family, built the what was then St. Augusta Cathedral and now Calvary Cathedral and previously Calvary Cathedral in Sioux Falls. And so that was part of what really got him in a snit when Maggie arrived in the city, because she was also affiliated with the Astor family. And this made him personally embarrassed mm-hmm. because of his connection. And I believe that that personal concern is part of what motivated him. Now, he had long been outspoken against divorce. He really did believe it to be an evil. That's certainly what the Episcopal Church said as well.
Mm-hmm.
And part of where it seems to have come from for Bishop Hare was from this real paternalism, from this real sense that he needed to protect women. And he believed that divorce could be an evil perpetrated on women by husbands who would leave them. And that seems to be part of where his incredible dislike and ultimate decision to spend most of the remainder of his life fighting against divorce came from.
Mm-hmm. And then toward the end of your book, too, you talk about how these vast distinctions between a few states, like South Dakota and Nevada, I think was the other one that had such low or short-time residency requirements in other states. What were the other states that were kind of on the other end of the spectrum?
So, yeah, in a lot of states, you had residency requirements that were a year. Most places were a year. So there was not a lot of value in moving from state to state if you were going to need to be there for over a year in mm-hmm. order to get a divorce. That did not seem to be a possibility for a lot of people. Now some tried. Maggie, the first time she tried to get a divorce, she went to Rhode Island, which had more options for divorce than New York did. And she went to Newport, where her family had long owned mansions. And she was prepared to stay there for a year in order to gain residency and file for a divorce. Now, what happens in Maggie's case is that her family figures out what she's up to. And she is subjected to incredible family and social pressure not to pursue this divorce. So that was honestly one of the other attractive things about South Dakota and Sioux Falls, was that for many of these women from New York or from Chicago or from Washington, D.C., it was a long way from the people who had influence over their lives. Mm-hmm. So they could go and they could wait out their stay without their families trying to intervene.
Hmm. Well, circling back to the church leaders and Bishop Hare, what other choices might they have? I mean, the bishop dives into politics. Would there have been other choices that Bishop Hare considered in modifying this or protecting women, as you say, that he might have?
Yeah. So when he first decides he is going to dive into this, he does so with a sermon. You know, he sort of does so with the typical tools that he might have had at his disposal. He writes an open letter in the church news, in the church bulletin, mm-hmm. Basically politely asking divorce colonists not to, you know, participate or, you know, be prominent in his congregation, because a lot of the divorce colonists did worship at his church. So he uses what you might think of as the typical tools that a religious leader might have at his disposal. And when he realizes that that is not having an influence, and when he realizes that most of his fellow clergy in Sioux Falls are saying similar things, and that does not seem to be changing the trajectory, mm-hmm. That's when he decides, much to his own surprise, that he is going to seek out a legislative relief to this as opposed to a religious one.
Okay. And that occurs 1907?
So it occurs a couple of times, actually. Okay. So in 1893 is the first time that Bishop Hare dives into this from a legislative point of view. So in 1893, South Dakota changes the law from 3 months residency to 6 months residency.
Okay.
This is not as long as some opponents wanted. It's much, much longer than the divorce colonists want, but that's where they end up. They announce, you know, yes, the divorce colony is closed, and they expect that everyone will now move on to Fargo, mm-hmm. because North Dakota still has the 3 month residency requirement. You don't see a lot of people going to Fargo. You do see some. But you don't see a lot, and I think there are two reasons for that. One is, it is not as easy to spend 6 months or 3 months in Fargo as it is to spend 6 months in Sioux Falls.
Right.
So you're still going to come, and you're still going to spend time at this hotel and sort of use these kind of well-worn, by this point, well-worn channels for getting a divorce.
Right.
You're going to follow in the footsteps of the women before you.
Right.
And I think that's the other reason it doesn't change, which is, Sioux Falls, by this point, it's been about 2 years, Sioux Falls has a reputation. And you see that even once the laws change, the way that national newspapers talk about the city doesn't change very much.
Hmm.
So you still have this reputation. And you need to think about how information flows at this moment. It's not like I can Google where to go get an easy divorce, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I have learned this from headlines. I have learned this from other people who know someone who went. And so the reputation of the city does not change instantaneously upon the change of the laws.
Okay.
So anyway, that's Bishop Hare's first attempt.
Mm-hmm.
Later, in 1899, North Dakota changes its law to be 1 year residency.
Oh.
So now all of a sudden, 6 months in Sioux Falls is short again.
Yeah.
And everyone comes on back.
Mm-hmm.
That's when we set out for this second battle around the divorce colony. And yes, to your point, Bishop Hare, again, in 1907, is involved in some of the legislative efforts to change the laws. Now, by this point, he's quite ill, mm-hmm. so he is not as active as he was the first time around, but he's still really influential.
And I think that law has been referred to a popular ballot. Is that correct? In 1908?
It in fact was, yes. Yeah, so they attempt to change it to a year residency requirement, and then that does go to a referendum.
And was it put on the ballot because people thought it would be defeated?
So this was actually a last-ditch effort by those who wanted to keep the law the same, did
right.
not want to make it more difficult
right.
To get a divorce. It was very unlikely, even from the moment they decided they were going to attempt to override this one-year residency requirement with a popular vote, it was very, very unlikely that there were going to be enough people who supported the idea of divorce to overrule this. That said, the number of people who agreed to sign a petition and the number of people who did vote for it is so far and away a larger show of support for divorce than you would have gotten 20 years earlier,
mm-hmm.
That I think you need to recognize it as a victory for the acceptance of this being a necessary part of a world that has marriage is also the opportunity to dissolve that.
Okay. So then it does remain then as a 12-month residency requirement?
Yes. The referendum fails and it remains as a 12-month residency requirement.
Right. And the referendum fails, I think, in your book at 60% or so of the vote.
Yeah.
I looked up some sources and I saw what else was on the referendum ballot in 1908. So on the same ballot, is a referendum about taxes, which is not that surprising, a referendum about the Attorney General's salary, a referendum about local liquor control,
mm-hmm.
A referendum about protection of quails hunting, which I guess the population of quail had long been an issue since territorial days, and a referendum against Sunday performance, which passed but by a super narrow margin. So of those six, three passed, and the divorce one passed. The protection of quail got more votes than the divorce. So it's always interesting to see about thinking in time and what else is going on and what the hot political issues are.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were some efforts in that to sort of build a coalition around anti-prohibition and pro-divorce, but
mm-hmm.
that all sort of fell apart in the days before the referendum.
Right, right. And this is 10 Novembers prior to women's suffrage passing in South Dakota. So women still can't vote. So these are all men voting for this. I think that's important
mm-hmm.
to kind of highlight who's voting and so forth. I wonder if you could, the legal aspect of this or the cottage industry that grows up about divorce law and family law. There's some interesting lawyers that are in this story, too. Who would you like to kind of call out to the listeners about who are the lawyers who are assisting the process here in Sioux Falls in South Dakota?
Yeah, so one of the things that I really liked was the fact that you had the Cataract House on one corner and then you had the Edmondson Jameson block on the other corner there. And there were so many lawyers in that office building. And it really seemed to have sort of an outsized number of lawyers for the size of the city, at this particular moment.
Yeah.
One of the people, he's a judge early in the divorce colony. Judge Aiken is one of the people I find really interesting. He goes from being the judge who's deciding on these divorce cases and sort of at different points during his tenure as a judge, he is the sort of darling of those who oppose divorce, and later he's the darling of those who want divorces.
Mm.
And then after he leaves the bench, he becomes a pretty prominent divorce attorney in town. And so I found him to be a pretty fascinating character because sort of everyone in this story at some point or another thinks that he is going to be their savior.
Yeah. Well, at one point, is it Flora who winds up marrying her? Or which one of the...
You're thinking of Blanche.
Blanche, yes.
So, Wallace Scott, it's he is her attorney, and then later, once she has gotten her divorce, to the great shock of Sioux Falls, they sneak off to Chicago and get married, and then Blanche moves back to Sioux Falls. And that was something that, to my knowledge, no divorced colonist had previously done.
Uh-huh.
Now, of course, these women had to swear in court that they were residents of South Dakota and that they had not come entirely for a divorce. They had mm-hmm. come because they wanted to live in South Dakota. And almost to a person, they leave immediately after getting a divorce, especially in the early years.
Right.
So, you know, by the time Blanche has gotten her divorce and remarried, it's just so shocking to Sioux Falls to realize that they are going to have to figure out how to deal with one of these divorced colonists permanently as part of their community.
Yeah. And how do they fare? Do they live a long, happy life?
Not so well.
Oh,
yeah,
boy.
No, it's pretty rough for Blanche.
Yeah.
She and her husband are sort of excluded from some clubs that Wallace had previously been a part of. And then later, although I will say, Blanche does, it doesn't make the book, but Blanche does have a singing performance in town. And the place is pretty packed, although it seems like a lot of people have turned out mainly out of curiosity, mm-hmm. not out of support.
Right, right. Was that at the Cataract Hotel, or where was that performance?
You know, that I don't remember, but it was not at the Cataract. It was one of the theaters.
Okay. As you end the book, you kind of talk about how divorce laws in the 60s and 70s then change around the country. Theodore Roosevelt posits or tries to get an amendment to the Constitution about divorce. So that doesn't go anywhere. But I think at the national level, a lot of the national leaders are trying to sort out how do we deal with these states that have very low residency requirements or short residency requirements. Mexico, right across the line, you can mm-hmm. get a divorce there very quickly and then come back. And then finally, and then New York, which holds on to its pretty high bar in 2010, all the way till 2010. You mentioned Governor Rockefeller and his divorce. I thought it was ironic, I guess, in some ways, and sad in others, that Governor Rockefeller in 1962, he and his wife divorce, and she goes to Reno to get the divorce because New York's laws are still so restrictive. How does that kind of stuff change into what is common now, no-fault divorce, and where's that kind of change over time land us, do you think?
Yeah, absolutely. So as we've discussed, you know, it's about 1908 when the Sioux Falls divorce colony truly shuts down.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when, as you mentioned, people start going to Reno. And what's a little different about the story in Nevada is that with one brief exception, the laws in Nevada continually get shorter. So each the residency requirement gets shorter until I think it's sometime in the 1930s. You can go and you can stay there for just 6 weeks in order to become a resident and get your divorce.
Hmm.
So to me, that's part of what makes Sioux Falls a really interesting tipping point in this conversation, because this is the last point where really you see the divorce opponents winning the argument. And they're winning the legal argument at this point. What they're not winning is the social argument anymore.
Right.
So what I find really interesting is I mentioned earlier, there's a report that the U.S. government puts out just before the start of the divorce colony about the number of divorces. Then just after the close of the divorce colony, just after this referendum we were discussing, there is another report that comes out. And for those who oppose divorce, it's a very disappointing report, because what you find is that over the basically 20 years where people who oppose divorce have thrown everything they possibly can at divorce, so they have put up religious barriers, they've put up legal barriers, they've put up social barriers, they've put up political barriers, it really didn't matter. People are still going to get the relief they want. So we still see divorce rates rising. And that's the other thing that sort of makes Sioux Falls this tipping point. Now, it's mostly a tipping point in social acceptance, because as you point out, it takes a long time for the laws to change after that. And we see a sort of slow evolution into the universal no-fault version of divorce we have today.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think you find over this time is that states largely start to recognize that their laws aren't doing them any good. So people are finding ways to separate, be that sort of extra legal, be that making agreements outside of the court so that they can live separate lives,
mm-hmm.
be it them going to another state or going to Mexico, where at one point you could, in fact, get a divorce in one day in mm-hmm. one Mexican state. And so because people have found ways around the law, states have very little control over this part of marriage, and that is of concern to them. So you basically start seeing laws change to catch up with reality, so that the courts and the state can have some say over how marriages end. And that's largely where you get the push towards more realistic divorce laws.
Mm-hmm. Well, and residency has a lot of entry into various facets of life, everything from taxes to hunting licenses, right? So I imagine they're kind of balancing, state governors and legislators are balancing all of that stuff up against this kind of one 800-pound gorilla in the room, the divorce aspect of the law, and thinking people are getting around it anyway, just as you said, and perhaps we need to think about other facets of our policy that hinge on residency requirements.
Yeah, and you raise a good point. It was the difference between the statutes in various states that caused a lot of problems.
Mm-hmm.
We see it play out during the era of the divorce colony, where you will have a woman come home with a divorce decree from South Dakota, but her husband back in New York believes that's not valid, and the courts
right.
have to try to sort that out.
Mm-hmm.
We have one instance in which a man from Massachusetts comes home with a divorce decree. He remarries. He then passes away, and his first wife decides to claim that she is his heir.
Yeah.
And this case makes it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Wow.
So we have a lot of questions of, like, are you married? Are you not married? Are you married in some states but not others? A lot of potential confusion. Are your children legitimate or illegitimate, depending mm-hmm. on what state they live in? And that confusion led people to think about how to make the laws more uniform, because you really potentially had a lot of problems there.
Right. Well, let's talk about sources a little bit. In the acknowledgments, you mentioned the state archives, and Ken Stewart was the archivist there. Sarah Casper, I think, helped you out at times at the state. That's great that you were able to interact with them. And what were some of your other sources?
Yeah, so the very first thing I did when I saw the words "the divorce colony" was call up the courthouse, the current courthouse
mm-hmm.
In Minnehaha County,
mm-hmm.
and say, hey, do you have these divorce records from, 100 plus years ago?
Right.
And their answer was yes.
Yeah.
And I was living in Massachusetts at the time, or I guess I was living in Pennsylvania at the time, actually. It's
mm-hmm.
a long time I've been working on this project. I was living in Pennsylvania at the time, and I was going to fly out there. And so I said, do you really have these divorce records? And in fact, they do have a lot of them. And they were incredibly kind and helpful at the beginning of my research, giving me an opportunity to look at the court dockets from the era and sort of understand the scope of what this story was, and then start digging into some actual divorce files that they still had on microfilm. The state archives was wonderful to start tracking down some of those additional records that were sort of scattered among various other courthouses in the state, but had mm-hmm. been accessioned by the archives.
Right.
So that was a real starting point for me in terms of understanding if I could tell this story in the way that I wanted to.
Right. Well, your research is very thorough, not only the newspapers, which, of course, as you pointed out, they have their agenda of selling a story. So you always have to take it with a big grain of salt, exactly what they're saying. But the records are, they also have an audience and a purpose, and so you need to kind of weigh all that. You clearly had a great advisor in Nancy Cott, who's written a book on marriage. I'm wondering how your book kind of fits within maybe a larger scope of what she's done about the history of marriage.
Yeah, so one of the things that Dr. Cott did that was really influential for me is in one of her books, Public Vows, she lays out sort of a a really succinct understanding of the importance of understanding social pressures on marriage. And in reading this, I sort of came to understand that we had not looked at divorce through this same historical lens that she was looking at marriage through.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, this idea, so her thesis is that there are essentially three levels of public influence on a private marriage. So she is saying, you know, you have friends and family and immediate neighbors in the community, and they exercise this control over a marriage through their approval and disapproval. And you feel that really intensely as a couple.
Mm-hmm.
And then you also have this level of sort of state control, legislatures and judges, they're setting the terms. And then you have these federal policies and these federal values that provide incentives or disincentives to do various things in marriage. And that really was a lens through which I wanted to look specifically at divorce.
Okay.
And to think about not just what was happening legally, because we have a very good history of the legal evolution of divorce in the United States. Lots of amazing scholars have looked at this. But often they overlook or lump into a larger category, the Sioux Falls divorce colony, with other places that had served as destinations for unhappy spouses previously. And for me, once I applied Dr. Cott's framework to the idea of divorce, it's when it became clear to me that in Sioux Falls, we saw a social tipping point that we hadn't really appreciated as much as we should up until now.
April, thanks a lot for your fascinating book and the great conversation. Again, the book is entitled The Divorce Colony. It's published by Hachette Group just this June. Thanks again for this, and thanks for sharing your book. And we've learned a lot about Sioux Falls through this and certainly South Dakota. Thanks, April, for joining us.
We'd like to thank Howard and Dorothy Gruver for their passion for history and the support of the South Dakota State Historical Society. It's through gifts such as theirs that we're able to tell South Dakota's history.
When a tornado hits a town, I've never been able to figure out which houses were the Democrats, or the Republicans, or the Libertarians. I never knew who the Norwegians were, the Swedes, or the Czechoslovakians or the Germans. Of course, everybody wants to point out who the Irish are, but other than that.
History 605 is produced by the South Dakota State Historical Society, and its audio engineer is the amazing Kevin Larson. We'd like to thank our partner, South Dakota Public Broadcasting, and most importantly, we'd like to thank you for listening. Please rate us on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to fine podcasts. We'll be back in a couple weeks with another episode of History 605.